the progress that's been made recently, and then the beyond bit here is meant to interest and excite you, okay? Because I want to suggest the way we can go beyond just understanding galaxy formation in our universe. Kate, now I should just briefly acknowledge that I didn't do all this work. Key people like Ian McCarthy and Andrew Benson, and a lot of the numerical work I'll talk to was undertaken by as part of the OWLS project, which is led by Hugh Shea in Leiden. Okay, so part one. There are basically four parts to this talk. Maybe to be fast, I'll skip one of the bits. But we're talking here about the late universe and how the galaxies form. All right, but don't switch off on me, because it's worth holding in there until you get to the end. So eventually, so the idea is, I want to get from here, right, about 1,000 years after the Big Bang, when everything is nice and linear and there are little fluctuations, everything's easy, to here, okay, which is about 10 years after the Big Bang, and everything is very complicated, and we have lots of little galaxies lighting up the universe. And the challenge for galaxy formation modeling is to understand how you go from this to this and get the right answer. Okay? And it would be nice to go further in that direction and further in that direction. Those are achievable things. Okay, so how do we solve the galaxy formation problem? Well, essentially, it's made up of four components. There's the first thing, we need a cosmological model that underlies this, so as we see fluctuations in density. We can then evolve those fluctuations in density forward in that cosmological model through a numerical n-body simulation, or some of the analytic approximations to that. Okay. But in order to produce something that we can compare with the actual universe we see, we need to allow for the gas processes. So that's the cooling, the star formation, this mysterious thing that I'll come back to later of feedback. So how do galaxies form? Well, it works something like this. Is we have start with the seed fluctuations in density, gravitational instability. Gravity is a funny thing in that the lowest entropy states gravitating systems are strongly clustered. So it's quite unlike normal systems that you're used to. Maybe not here. If I give this talk at another institute, that would be true, right? But that leads to virialized dark matter halos. It doesn't give you galaxies. The reason you get galaxies is the baryonic component can cool. And so The lowest entropy, no, I do mean the highest entropy state is most organized, right? So the gas can radiate energy and collapse can proceed until you're left with a cold gas disk supported purely by angular momentum. And in that cold gas is where you get stars, okay? An ultimate state of that cold material. But unfortunately for models of galaxy formation, that's not the end of it. Okay, so I can just run a little movie, but everybody's probably seen this kind of thing before, to show you what happens with the gravitational instability. Okay, we start with a relatively uniform distribution of mass. It clusters together. It gets more and more strongly nonlinear. Material falls into these filaments, which then drain together to create objects. And each of these objects, we want to be able to put a little galaxy at the center of each of these, and then to compare it to the picture of the real universe that I showed you. Okay, and just to stress again that this is the kind of cartoon that we can have about the collapse of gravitational halos, the radiation, the loss of energy by cooling, formation of an angular momentum-supported disk. Okay. But unfortunately, what makes the problem complicated is there's this thing called feedback. Okay. That we know that this runaway cooling situation here is presented by putting energy in from stars as they age, which turns some of the cold gas here back into the hot phase. And understanding exactly how that works is really critical to producing galaxies that look anything like the real universe. Okay. So if we, and it's a complicated problem. To the extent that the efficiency of this feedback is sufficient that only about 10% of the baryons in the universe form into stars. So only a very small fraction of the total fuel that's available actually gets locked up into stars. Now, you can try and avoid this by putting in some energy as the stars form. From the massive stars will undergo a supernova explosion that deposits energy. But since the density can be very high, this easily overpowers that deposition of density. Yet we know that the real universe only has 10% of the baryons locked into stars. And the problem is that the interstellar medium of our galaxy is not just a simple fluid. Okay. It's not a simple fluid, so when I put energy in, I don't just heat it up a little bit. I actually split it into two components, a very dense phase that's still able to cool very rapidly and form stars, and a hot, tenuous phase that's, because it's tenuous, won't be able to radiate, won't be able to cool down again, and won't form stars, will flow out of the galaxy. But that's a very small-scale process to understand. There's also potentially a key role that might be played by black holes. Okay, these put in a lot more energy than simply come from the supernova and might be able to heat up a lot more of the gas so that the radiative efficiency is not sufficient. Okay, so we have those components, and then this slide is here just to emphasize what we need to do in order to model galaxy formation. So the plot that I'm showing here is called the galaxy luminosity function. Essentially, it shows the number of galaxies of a particular mass. Okay, this is actually an observed luminosity in the infrared, but it correlates very well with the mass of a galaxy. And so this at end of the scale is very massive galaxies. This is low mass galaxies. And yet, what I want to contrast is the shape of this function, which is observed, against the predicted shape of the dark matter halo mass function. Okay. And so I can arbitrarily choose a normalization, a mass to light ratio, but if I plot these two curves on the same diagram, you see that they don't look anything like each other. So that's the nature of the galaxy formation problem. So first of all, I have to explain, why is the observational data very flat here? So as I go to low mass galaxies, there isn't much of an increase in the number of galaxies per unit mass, whereas the dark matter halo mass function increases very steeply. Okay. But there's a second problem, and that's at the bright end, this galaxy abundance curve cuts off very rapidly. Okay, notice the logarithmic scale on this side. So above a certain brightness, which incidentally is about the brightness of the Milky Way, the abundance of galaxies plummets very, very fast, and much faster than the abundance of dark matter halos as a function. So I have to come up with a scheme in my galaxy formation model that will explain both of these discrepancies. Okay, and this is just to convince you about the idea of feedback, that as I try to form a galaxy, what's very important is the energy deposited by supernovae. So this is a dwarf galaxy M81 and M82. The mass is being expelled from this by a starburst region in the center, blowing material out. And it's color-coded, so that I think the blue is the X-ray emission, the red is the H-alpha emission, tracing different components of hot gas. And the fuzzy disk here is the stars and galaxy. So you can see from this picture that it's not just a one-way process. I don't just put material into a galaxy. I can also have flows that go out of the galaxy as well. Right, so how do we go about solving this problem? Well, one approach is just to write down the fundamental physics equations of fluid dynamics and solve them. And you could do this by using the SPH method, for example, which stands for smooth particle hydrodynamics. And essentially, you represent the density at a point by taking an average over the density of particles. And you associate each of those particles with a particular pressure or entropy, and you can therefore compute the effect of these pressure forces on the motion of the particles. Now, this is quite a good way of discretizing the hydrodynamic equations, but without an additional term here associated with the viscosity, you won't ever get to change the entropy. So there's a whole part of the code which talks about the change in the entropy or the adiabat of a particle as it dissipates the bulk kinetic energy of the fluid's motion. Now, it has lots of advantages, this scheme, okay, in that it explicitly enforces conservation of things, and it also has a benefit that the gas density can never be negative because it's always represented by particles. So that's one way to go about solving this problem. Okay, so, and there are other techniques. For instance, you could have an adaptive mesh technique where you solve fluid equations on a discrete mesh. Okay, now, but the problem is, that's not really the problem we're trying to solve here. Okay, we also have to include these additional components that I talked about. So the cooling of the baryons, their ability to lose energy and radiate, that's maybe okay that we can compute those. But we also need to have some scheme that includes star formation in this. We need to have some scheme that accounts for the supernovae in this. And we maybe also need to be able to form black holes in this code as well. So in order to do this, it's not as simple as you might have hoped, right? You need to have an ultra-high resolution in order to have a hope of properly modeling the formation of stars and their interaction with these things. It's a potential problem that these aren't really the right equations when you get down to the level of individual star-forming regions. You would need to potentially include the magnetic field in solving this computation. But really, the main problem is that the current computers are far too slow to cover the range of dynamical scales, at a factor of 10 to the 8 or something, that you would need to get in order to model these processes properly and at the same time model a cosmological volume. So I think somewhere, yes, okay. So here's what you can do with current computers. Okay, so these are two different views, an X and a Y view of the same galaxy. We'll eventually form a spiral galaxy, which will be face-on in one, edge-on in the other. This corresponds to the stars that are formed, and this corresponds to the density. And so you can run this smooth particle hydrodynamic code. You can create a galaxy like this, but I think you can already see that the resolution here is enough to resolve a cold gas disk in this galaxy, but it's not able to resolve individual star-forming regions. And it's not able to take into account the complicated interaction of having a multiphase medium. So the point I wanted to make was that whilst a movie like this might look good, it's not necessarily bearing much relationship to reality. And in particular, this movie was just showing you one particular galaxy. If you wanted to be able to compute a reasonable section of the volume of the universe, you wouldn't be able to have even this much resolution in your calculation. This included the full gravitational physics, the hydrodynamics. It had recipes for doing the feedback from star formation. It doesn't have black holes in. It tries to overcome some of these subgrid problems by switching off cooling for gas immediately after it's been heated up by a supernova. And that's why it comes out as something reasonable. But I'd argue that this simulation produces a galaxy which is far too massive for the kind of halo that it's in. And that's not evident because you've just got one galaxy, so you're free to go, well, this looks like a great picture. What you need to compare it with is the proper statistical distribution. Sorry? So that was run with Takashi Okamoto's code, which is a version of Gadget, say, 2.5. So Focus Bringle made a public version of the Gadget code. Takashi spent some time enhancing that to make it run faster. Okay. So it uses, for instance, the entropy conserving form of those SPH equations to do the integrals. So Takashi spent a long time doing the metal enrichment, the supernovae, etc., trying to achieve those. It's in some ways similar to the code used in the OWLS project that I'll talk about in a little while. Okay, now, so let me talk about then a different approach to this problem, okay? And that's what's commonly referred to as semi-analytic galaxy formation. And so the idea here is rather than trying to follow the hydrodynamic equations, we're going to try and reduce the problem of galaxy formation down to a set of coupled nonlinear differential equations. And so each part of the galaxy formation process, hopefully we can model this in terms of some physics that you understand that makes good physical sense in terms of being able to think about it. This is very fast, okay? I'm not trying to solve this on a particle-by-particle basis. I can solve it on the basis of an individual galaxy, okay? And so it's very fast. Now, the key thing about that is it's therefore easy for me to change assumptions and get a new set of results, and I can do that on the computers in Durham in about 10 minutes for a 500 megaparsec cube volume of the universe. So that's fast. Of course, you have to worry if you made the wrong assumptions when you produced your differential equations, you're going to get the wrong answer. But of course, we don't do that. Now, okay, now, so this is just to illustrate some of these equations. Okay, so for instance, you can have, this is what's referred to as the Preschecter formula for the distribution of halos at a particular time in the universe, a number of virialized halos per logarithmic interval in mass. Okay, you can have descriptions that tell you about what's the rate at which material cools and falls onto the galaxy at the center of the halo. That involves implicitly in here this definition of the cooling time as a function of time and radius. You can relate the rate at which stars form to the mass of the gas. Okay, and you could focus that on, say, an observational law, or you could just experiment with different parameterizations of this. Okay. But an important component is that this rate at which we'll be forming stars is also balanced by a rate at which we heat stuff up from the galaxy. Okay. So we can write similar equations that relate the cold gas in the galaxy, how material is expelled from the galaxy, and what happens to that. Now, that's a small subset. If you want to really see how we do this, well, we're just putting a new paper on AstroPH by Andrew Benson and myself. I think this is a 50-page paper in which we just focus on trying to do a really good job of making the best approximations we can to these individual equations. So MR is the mass. So this, one of the things that we do differently in this paper compared to the previous versions, is this is the rate at which material is returned from the stars to the interstellar medium of the galaxy. So as the stars age, they return material to the interstellar medium. Now, previously, what you've done is to assume that material is returned instantaneously. In this one, we allow for the slight time delay between forming the stars and returning some of that material. It's only 50 pages. It won't take you that long to read it. Okay. So
I know. It was kind of, I thought, well, I'll show that there are real equations here. So evidently that was a mistake. I should have guessed that with this audience, right? So fx is the fraction. So as you heat this material up in the galaxy, you can return it to the halo of the galaxy, and it can cool back down again. But you can also heat it so much that it flows out of the halo completely. And so this is saying that the fraction that it flows out of the halo is dependent on the potential of the halo divided by some kind of mean energy of the material expelled by supernovae. Okay, and the reason you've got two equations here is this one tells you how much you expel, but we have to then allow for subsequent generations of halo that are going to re-accrete some fraction of that gas. Okay. Took a while to get it to work properly. Because you've got to remember that there's a tree of dark matter halos going into this as well. So within a halo, you can take a small time step and repartition the mass between these different channels. This one kind of messes that up a little bit because this allows you to take some mass from one halo and transport it to a halo at a later time. But that's been done. And then, of course, at the next time step, the halo mass will grow. Some of that mass grows by accreting diffuse material that's never been in a halo before. Some of it comes from other halos that you've already done this calculation for. Then you have to merge the properties of the two halos. Right. Okay, and so the disadvantage of this approach is that there are some parameters that you don't understand exactly what their values should be. So I don't want you to go and read this in detail, but this is just a frightening table of things we don't know. But it's really physics that we don't know because it's very low. We're trying to do this. Those are things that to simulate, you would have to go to very high resolution to get there. Okay, I want to briefly talk about then some successes of this type of modeling. And so one of these is we wanted to take the dark matter mass function and we wanted to shape it to match the observed data. And you see that there are two problems. One is that we have far too many small galaxies. The physics that's going to go on here is that the supernovae have a fixed energy. So when I form stars in a small galaxy, it's much easier to expel the gas than it is in a large galaxy. And so that's going to result in flattening this down. And if I make that effect strong enough, I can flatten the faint end to match the data reasonably well. Something like this. But an interesting effect is that this creates a problem. So since these small galaxies are now very inefficient at converting baryons into stars, there's loads of baryons left in the universe that can form stars in bigger mass objects where the supernovae are not effective. So the problem that's been around for a long time is that we sort of understood, even from some of the earliest papers, how, in principle, to flatten this part of the diagram, but it's how to understand what the shape is out here. Now, the initial papers had enough freedom to choose the baryon fraction in the universe that they could sort of match the shape here. But if you take the new cosmological measurements, there's no way you can get this bend to match the observed properties.
So can you flatten it completely? Because you still have the wrong slope there. So if I go to even low mass halos, things will go wrong again, right?
Yes. No. So if I keep going, in this model, I'd have a problem, for instance, in the Milky Way. There'd be far too many satellite galaxies in a Milky Way-like halo. Okay. Now, one of the beauties of this approach is I can fix the physics. And so if I say this is as flat as you can get it, if you kind of make the, as you go to a lower mass halo, you can eject more gas, but it only goes as the square of the velocity, of the characteristic velocity of the halo. If you allow yourself some freedom to think, oh, well, in small halos,
somehow the coupling of how that gas gets coupled to the supernova ejector is going to be different in large mass galaxies. Although you don't understand that, this flattens out and becomes a much better match to the data. But actually understanding that is a challenge, right? So we kind of know what the answer has to be, but we don't know why.
But if you look at heavy starburst dwarf galaxies, yep, which is what you're dealing with there, at least Leonard and these guys claim that the efficiency of coupling approaches unity, which I was pretty stunned by. I heard that.
Yeah, but that's not enough to do this, right?
Okay. So what do you? I assume you were assuming something like a few percent. Are you?
No. So out here we're getting a kind of an order. The mass ejected is comparable to the mass formed into stars. But down in this part, very much more material is being ejected than is being formed into stars.
Okay, excellent.
And this was here to show you that essentially that's a numerical code doing the same thing. It gives the same problem. So it's not just that we're using the wrong semi-analytic approximations. Okay, now. I want to get on. So this was talking about the bright end of the luminosity function. There is several other related problems, but you'll have to come to my talk tomorrow if you want to know about those. Okay, so the exciting thing that's been happening is that we've realized that there are black holes in the universe. Okay. Now, so astronomers talk about them as active galactic nuclei, but essentially they mean black holes in the middle of galaxies. Now, so the new thing is to look at the energy that's produced in forming a black hole, assuming something like 10% of the accreted energy onto the black hole is available to heat up the surrounding material. And you can see, if you take the kind of halo where galaxy formation becomes inefficient again, at the high mass end, has a sort of thermal energy of 10 to the 61 Hertz. That kind of galaxy we know observationally would have a black hole of maybe 10 to the 9 solar masses. And so the energy released creating this black hole, I can compute the energy available. It's roughly 2 times 10 to the 62. And so, originally I just used to frighten people with this number, but you can immediately see from the comparison of those two energies that the black hole, it's really hard to believe that the black hole has no effect on the formation of galaxies in big halos like this, right? So, okay, but the challenge was to understand and try and come up with a model for how that might work. So if I'd had more time, I would have put one of Brian's slides in here, but I didn't. So this shows the possible ways that black holes could affect the formation of galaxies. So theoreticians would like you to focus on this panel. And so this is a simulation from Springle and DiMatteo showing that when two galaxies collide, it's likely that you trigger a large flow of material onto the black hole at the center. That produces a lot of energy and expels gas from the galaxy, rather like the supernovae, but there's much more energy available than this. The trouble with that mechanism is it doesn't really do much in the long term. The gas eventually comes back and cools back down again. So what was more interesting was to discover that there's observationally signs of strong interactions between black holes, that you see as radio sources at the centers of clusters of galaxies. And so you can see radio plasma, shown in red, being ejected from the black hole at the center. And what's interesting is that that seems to affect the properties of the X-ray emission, so the diffuse plasma that surrounds the galaxy. And if you go and do calculations about the energy balance here, you see that the energy being injected by the black hole roughly balances the energy that would be available for cooling, would be produced by the cooling of the gas. Okay, don't have time to talk about different modes of AGN accretion, but you can imagine that if the accretion rate is very low, you get a particular kind of accretion disk. Maybe it's worth stressing that. Okay, so if the accretion rate is high,
you develop a normal kind of Shakura-Sanaya disk where you have material flowing towards the black hole. Eventually it reaches this last stable orbit and plunges into the black hole. But as the material flows into the center, it radiates the energy that it's giving out as viscosity. Okay, that's removing the angular momentum. But there's another kind of black hole, an advection-dominated black hole, where as the material flows in, if it's too diffuse, it's not very radiatively efficient, and the energy stays trapped within the flow. Okay? Now, if the flow, the overall mass rate has to be quite low for this to happen, but the net result is that you end up with a disk that's very hot and puffy around the black hole before it plunges in. So one of the interesting results of this is that means that this black hole has the potential to be threaded by very large-scale magnetic fields that are generated in this disk. And so that's currently what's thought to launch these radio jets that we saw in the clusters. Okay, is what we would expect to see. Okay. So, going back to the model of galaxy formation, how can we include this? Well, the idea was that we realized that maybe the AGN would offset cooling. Okay. But we tried this a long time ago, actually, Andrew Benson and myself, and found it didn't get anywhere. But eventually, what we realized was that there's an important additional criterion. Heating something with the black hole, black hole is right at the center of the system. Somehow it has to get that information out into the surrounding material. And that's only possible if the sound crossing time of the system is shorter than the cooling time, which means that the system kind of stays around in a hydrostatic form and then slowly collapses. So for those kind of halos that are hydrostatic, the AGN provides an efficient way of offsetting the cooling of material. Now, there's a more complicated version of that that I won't go into. But the effect of this is that when the halo becomes sufficiently massive, that tends to coincide with it becoming hydrostatic and therefore susceptible to the AGN putting in energy and preventing the material cooling. So if we have a galaxy formation model without AGN, a large-ish halo, a few times 10 to the 13 solar masses, produces really quite a large galaxy. Okay? You can see that a lot of the mass of that galaxy arises at late time. So, sorry, this is redshift 6 down to the present day. What's plotted here is the fraction of mass in different forms. In blue, it's hot gaseous material. The stars that are formed, the bulge of the galaxy are shown in red, for the disk of the galaxy are shown in blue. This is from one of these semi-analytic calculations, okay? And so you can see that these are all the tiny little mass fragments that go to building up the halo, okay? And I've deliberately chosen something that sort of is quite like a large halo, even at redshift 3, and then it sort of grows by accreting little pieces. If I'd chosen another one of these randomly, it might have grown, and then there might have been a merger of two big halos at some point in its history. But then it gets more complicated for me to show you. The point I want to illustrate is that when we switch on the AGN, the black hole, that has a dramatic effect in suppressing the late-time cooling in this halo. Okay. We arrive at a much smaller galaxy than we would have without it. And so that galaxy, if we run this model, we end up with something that looks much more like the data. So focus on this panel, which shows you again the bright galaxies are at this end, the faint galaxies are down here. This is the abundance of those galaxies. And you can see without the AGN, there's far too many big bright things. With the AGN, you produce a dramatic reduction. Okay, now the interesting thing about that was we took that model, we adapted the parameters in order to get a good match to the present day properties of galaxies. But then we were able to look at the properties of galaxies earlier in the history of the universe, so out to redshift 4.5. And it worked well in describing that. Okay, and so, right, I think I have to skip over this, but just want to stress that, remember, only 10% of the baryons are locked up in the stars and galaxies. We ought to worry about what about the properties of the rest of the galactic material. And so this is what I've called the flip side of galaxy formation. So it's not only enough that we have to get the properties of the stars right, but we want to get the properties of the diffuse material that's left over. And this shows that this is non-trivial either, in that if you just have a fixed fraction of material in the halo, you dramatically over-predict the amount of the X-ray luminosities of halos. So this is, again, effectively the mass of a halo. Most massive halos out here. Low-mass halos in there. This is the predicted emission that we ought to see in X-ray wavelengths from that halo. And we dramatically, the black points are the observational data, the red points are the predictions of a simple model. But the nice thing about black holes is they not only get the properties of the galaxies right, but we'll also get the properties of the amount of gas in these hot halos correct as well. So again, it passes this test as well. Two very different things that it's not easy to satisfy both sets of constraints. Okay, you can worry about whether those results are purely due to me using the correct formulations in my semi-analytic recipes, and you can go and then do a numerical simulation to try and check this. Now, it's very hard to do that, I argued, on the properties of galaxies, but it's not so hard to do that, the properties of this diffuse material, on the flip side. And so you can make simulated observations of things you would compare to clusters. You can then go and compare various models now with what you observe. And they all do reasonably well in this plot. But if I plot the amount of cold gas, okay, my little wiggly lines, this shows a model which in which we included the AGN as the black holes, as an important source of feedback. The y-axis shows the amount of cold gas in the system versus halo mass. The shaded region shows the observational data. And you can see how this model works very well, whereas all of the other feedback schemes, this has no feedback at all. It's way too high in producing the amount of cold gas. This has the default way of doing supernova feedback that people normally use, still way too high. Can begin to get closer by having very strange parameterizations, but the simplest way is to include the black holes. And this matches up very well with what happens in the semi-analytic coding. Right, okay, so where are we? So I've talked about how we can model galaxy formation and what that might mean. I've talked about taking our current models and testing them against observational data. What I want to talk about now is what we could do with this in the future. Now, the first part of what we can do is that we currently, the semi-analytic model that I talked about, has 16 parameters in it. Okay, so it's like a 16-parameter problem. Now, previously, people have taken the attitude of, oh, well, I have to know what these parameters are, then I can run a model and know the answer. But really, we ought to be able to explore this parameter space. Okay. Now, and the way we've developed to do that is by using what's called Bayesian emulators, where we run the model at a set of points and then use these emulators to tell us what should happen at places where I haven't tried to evaluate the model. And if I, but because they're Bayesian, they tell me not just what I would expect to happen, but also how certain I am that a particular thing will happen. And a key part of this is then you can do kind of waves of emulation. You don't have to run your model at all points in parameter space equally well. I can do a very quick evaluation in some places, and then I know whether it's worth the additional computing expense to explore that region of parameter space further. Now, this was quite easy with the semi-analytic models. Okay, you can explore, it shows various sets of parameter space. The green points show acceptable regions that are predicted to produce acceptable matches to the observational data. And you see that really it looks like there are large regions of these parameters that could produce acceptable results. Okay. Slightly misleading view, because this is really a very thin plane that you're seeing projected in these 16 dimensions. So it looks like there are large, you know, you can choose almost any combination of parameters and you'll find something that's successful. That's purely a projection effect. You really, if you choose two parameters, the values you pick for the remaining 14 are often very tightly constrained. Okay. Right. And so if I actually do the runs at those points, I get very reasonable matches, for instance, to the luminosity function of galaxies. Okay. This was purely fitting to the mass function of galaxies, okay, to this data, requiring that those parameter combinations would give good results there.
That would be even smaller if you fit to clusters as well.
As you increase the amount of, well, clusters, yeah. Essentially, as you introduce more observational data that you're required to fit, this number goes down even faster. Okay, this is 0.5%. So, yes, so this is giving you these. You could then introduce another constraint from observational parameters. This would cut down some of these regions. In fact, it cuts in sort of orthogonal places in some of these planes. It cuts down the parameter space. Other observational data sets don't do anything, right? Already matching this is already enough of a constraint that the extra data that you add is redundant. But it's doable in a way that's Bayesian, and you can actually quantify how much you learned out of adding that additional data. Okay, and that's just trying to extract physics. So the idea is that we could go forward and we could use this technique, but now trying to do more of the calculation numerically. Okay. So the numerical simulations are good for treating things like the cooling of gas, and shock heating, basically the fluid dynamics. What they're not so good at is treating what's the small scale physics. And we could explicitly do that with our semi-analytic scheme. Okay, so you can imagine in the future that you would be able to do a tiered approach to simulations. So you'd do simulations of little patches of galaxies, where you'd learn about the physics of the interstellar medium. You could then use what you learned there to develop a subgrid model for simulations that were coarser resolution, and then run individual galaxies. Winds and jets, and then eventually you could work your way up to large-scale cosmological simulations. But the key point is, by coupling this to the Bayesian emulators, you're able to decide, well, is it worth pursuing that particular model for the galaxy patches any further, or is the result from running an individual galaxy already rule out that parameter combination? Okay. Right, so how could we turn this around and talk about the early universe? So I took on the Pi spirit and thought, well, let's go for a flight of fantasy, okay? Supposing we actually understood galaxy formation, right? Kind of there. There's a few things to sort out, but we're not that far off. The model seems to work pretty well, covering a wide variety of data sets. What would we do next? Well, that's an interesting challenge. So one of the things that I thought we could begin to do was to explore whether other universes were viable in the sense that they might produce observers. So we could, so for instance, my understanding of the multiverse is that we should, you know, we're just one of many islands of possible parameter space, where we have particular values of physical constants. But what we need is kind of to have some way of working out, well, is this a, if we consider other combinations of parameters, is that going to give us a viable universe for producing an observer? Okay, now the question though is to try and understand this in terms of, to put this not simply in terms of purely the number of galaxies. So one could just count the number of stars. Okay, but maybe that's a bit restrictive. We and what volume of the universe do you count over in order to do this? Wouldn't we like to have some measure that was, you know, how faint a galaxy do we need to have for this to count? So another approach that's been suggested is to actually look at the entropy that's generated as the galaxies form. And so this paper by Busso et al. Talk about the causal entropy diamond. So what they argue is that we should measure how viable a universe is by the amount of entropy it generates in a causally connected region of space. Right. And that would give us a way to go and say, well, how special then, we could integrate over various different kinds of initial condition and try and address this issue of, well, how special are we in terms of the parameters that we have? And this has been done primarily to ask about the cosmological constant, vacuum energy density, and see whether that is reasonable. So, but I also found this was an interesting way to think of the whole galaxy formation problem. So you can do these calculations, and this is a very quick calculation just to see what's happening, and to ask about what's the entropy generation due to different processes. Now, if we take the cooling of gas, okay, that I stressed was very important, I get an estimate of the entropy produced of around 4 times 10 to the 70 per cubic megaparsec. Okay. Now, what's interesting, but I guess it's just the same as the information I've already told you, but telling you in a different way, is what's the entropy generated by the feedback from supernova going off in galaxies. And it's interesting, this comes out with a very comparable number, which is maybe related to how we're actually able to regulate the formation of galaxies at all. And we can see that black hole, the feedback from the black holes, actually comes out as something bigger than that, and suppressing the formation of very large galaxies, but it's still really quite comparable. So you know, from what I see of running the code and how the presence of the black holes changes the production of stars, this all kind of seems to make sense in terms of how the universe is generating its entropy. But what's interesting is that the entropy you generate due to starlight is quite a bit bigger than these. Well, it's only about, you know, it's a factor of 100 bigger than the entropy due to cooling gas and supernovae. It's only a factor of 10 greater than that due to black hole feedback. Okay, so isn't this very interesting, right? That the primary method of generating entropy in our universe is actually the nuclear fusion that's happening in the cores of stars. I think the CMB is a much bigger number in terms of the absolute entropy. Mm-hmm. And so if I were to include that, that would add an extra contribution to the entropy. That's true, but I haven't included that here. The other thing I've not included is a black hole production due to horizon, the black hole horizon contribution,
which is way bigger than everything else. Okay. So, and I don't really understand that. Why is that so different compared to all these other components that are in here? But what does seem to make sense is that, you know, we live around a star, and so that maybe is entirely related to this dominance of starlight in the production of entropy. Maybe if this were much smaller, which would happen if the energy produced by nuclear fusion was less, the place to, you know, the forces generating life might be in some way related to the supernova feedback or to the cooling of the gas itself would be the dominant ways of producing entropy. Okay, so it seems like it's an encouraging way to go, and it would be fun to explore this further. I'm taking you could start the model with different initial parameters and see how the entropy production in those different universes compares. Okay, now when I tell people in Durham about this idea, they all think it's crazy, but what I want to stress is it's not stupid. Right? And the reason I recently realized doing a popular talk, and what I hadn't realized is because of the vacuum energy density, the future of our universe is really quite strange. So the Milky Way and Andromeda merge in the very near future, around the same as the lifetime of the Sun. But although the Milky Way is quite close to the Virgo cluster, the growth of the expansion of the universe means we never fall into it. And so in about 50 billion years in the future, all that's left in our observable region of the universe is one galaxy. We can't observe anything else. It's all been inflated away from us. So you can imagine that at some point in the future of the universe, that there's going to be some bright spark studying astronomy who then tries to simulate our galaxy and realizes that, oh, you know, there's not one galaxy. There could be all sorts of different galaxies in the universe. There could be elliptical galaxies, merging galaxies. And the only way you'd know about the existence of these other galaxies would be by computing them. Right? You wouldn't be able to observe them directly. And so, well, you know, the analogy is we're in exactly the situation, same situation in terms of our universe compared to the other universes that might be out there. The only way we have access to them is to actually do the calculations and compute in some suitable measure, whether they're likely to be observable. Okay, so I hope you think that's a fun idea. So what I briefly talked about was some of the past successes, about the problems of shaping the luminosity function, how we can model the properties of galaxy formation. And I tried to give you an outline of where we're going to go next, applying this semi-analytic philosophy, but trying to create this using many more, much more numerical calculation in that. Okay, and then the idea that maybe we can go beyond galaxy formation in our own universe and start to look at the viability of other universes. And the other idea that I think is very interesting is to think about how a universe is in some way a machine that generates entropy. We're purely a product living off that entropy production scheme. Okay, so thank you very much for listening.
Plenty of time for questions.
So going back to more of the things, right? So you claim that you lose very, if you get to very, very massive halos, the reason why I don't make these super big, super luminous galaxies is because of HN feedback.
Yes.
Right. So how does this fit with the HOD picture in which you claim, well, actually there are a couple of galaxies in really, really massive halos rendered? I mean, how does your approach relate to, I mean, can you reproduce HOD out of your approach?
Yeah, so one of the ways we compute correlation functions in this paper is actually to produce an HOD model, and then to use that to produce an actual predicted correlation function. And the calculations work really quite well in terms of producing the observed luminosity functions. The newer models that we're producing produce the dependence on galaxy mass, you know, pretty much in the way you would expect. They do break down, it's on very small scales, where we don't seem to get enough small, close approaches of galaxies. And this may be related to the fact that if we did the calculation numerically, if the reason you get galaxies close in the first place is a process of dynamical friction, which saps the energy of galaxies orbiting each other. We've done a careful job of trying to include that calculation correctly, but maybe there's something wrong with that approximation, and it would cause us to underestimate the number of close pairs. Now, it can't be too wrong, though, because the very sharpness of this break in the luminosity function is sensitive to that. If you make galaxies merge very easily, for instance, in a galaxy cluster, you will generate super big galaxies that will exceed the abundance that you observe purely by merging. Even though you've prevented the gas cooling and making bigger galaxies, merging can still make them bigger. And the shape is actually quite constraining in that respect. Okay. If you plot an interesting plot to make that I haven't got, is to plot halo mass versus the galaxy mass, isn't that halo? And for the models that work, you find this rises very, very rapidly. Okay. So the rise below the mass of the Milky Way is very, very rapid, which accounts for that very flat difference in faint galaxies. But then it rolls over, and basically you make the halo more massive, and you get very little gain in the mass of the galaxy. Once you get more massive than the Milky Way, it has a slight rise, which is due to this merger process. And so that matches, if you then take that and feed it through the whole model, this gives you reasonable correlation.
Have you made any successful predictions from this model?
So this is always a tricky issue. What counts as a... I don't mean post-fictions. Successful predictions. Well, the problem is that there's too much data, in a sense, so it's quite hard to come up with, the way we did the predictions for the what would happen to the abundance of galaxies as a function of redshift is we constrained the model locally, and then we asked what does it predict at high redshifts, but of course we knew the answer, so if it hadn't worked, I wouldn't have written the paper. We kept developing the model, right?
For example, was there some parameter you had to tweak to a surprisingly large value, and then you could say, well, if observers go and measure the radiation output by AGNs or something, they will find X.
I guess there are things like that. That's not quite absurd.
What's the most dramatic?
So one of those is the energy input we need to get the gas fractions arrive in groups of galaxies. Now, what you discover is that groups of galaxies contain a small fraction of the baryons you would think they contained if they had the universal fraction. So where are the baryons? And the model is saying that they're expelled outside those groups. How do they get there? You put in a lot of energy to push them out.
Energy coming from within the group? Or
from within the group, from the black hole. Now, it's no problem in terms of the mass of the black hole, because you get a lot of energy out of growing the mass of the black hole. There's actually Brian's observations that are a bit of a problem here, because the energy you see in bubbles and distortions of the X-ray surface brightness suggests that the energy input rate is significantly lower than. However, Brian can be wrong.
That hasn't happened yet. Yeah.
Actually, I have a question related to that. So, I'm not sure if you show a plot of gas, the total gas mass fraction versus mass. I noticed a star to baryon, but
did that get hidden away? That was probably
rushed through a bunch of them. So,
come on. That's it. So this is the baryon mass as a function of halo mass. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so this is showing you that what has to happen in order to get the observed X-ray luminosities of halos, right, is this X-ray emitting hot gas is very low in systems around 10 to 13 solar masses. 10 to the 12 solar masses, it begins to go up again. Okay. And this material has to be basically missing. Now, but if you go and observe this, and now the X-ray data is of good enough quality that you can observe it directly, you see that this is the model prediction, we're taking the fraction of hot gas in the halo, this is the observed data, and they agree pretty well. The fact that the model is maybe a bit lower than the data down here is purely because in order to observe this in X-rays, your system has to have some hot gas. And X-ray telescope time assignment committees hate giving you time to prove that there's no X-ray emitting gas in the halo. Right? So this fit is actually very good.
But do you have to tune the parameter or just the value that the AGM feedback you use to fit my gas?
So this fits everything. Okay. Same model is matching the properties of galaxies. It's matching the properties of the hot gas fraction.
So what happens above a KeV?
Well, that's a good question, right? Okay. So what's happening is eventually the halo gets so massive that the binding energy of the halo is much bigger than the energy you're getting out of the black hole. Okay? And so eventually, up here, even the black hole is not producing enough energy to change things. And so the clusters of galaxies around here are quite good, have most of the baryons that they should have if there were a universal value. Okay, so this rise is purely due to the biggest black holes in the universe, so maybe 10 to the 9 and a bit, 10 to the 10 solar masses. They can only heat up material in halos that are below a certain temperature. And it matches the data very well. And this is a semi-analytic calculation, but essentially you get the same results out of that numerical, and for the same reasons as well.
Other questions? So I have one. So you've emphasized the luminosity function of the galaxies, which is a blunt instrument. Right? So
I don't mind take exception.
What's an exception, but okay, it's a fine instrument, but there are others, which is the luminosity, the mass function of black holes. Okay, so you have a couple of, you're liberating binding energy here, and there are several ways to do it, some of which help you, that can do work on the universe, others that don't do work in the right places. Yep. But still, in the end, you've got to get sort of the mass and spin distribution of these things right at the end. And I'm wondering if you've looked at, and not only that, then the shape of galaxies, which I know in disks are one thing, but in ellipticals, their shapes can be pretty sensitive to the rate of black hole growth and the mode of black hole growth. And I'm wondering if you've looked at that, because that could be sort of the real sharp points that you need to get this.
Funnily enough, yes. And to an extent, it works, okay, and you can predict things. So you can show that you get the right quasar luminosity function. That's the principal mode of growing the black holes. So you see the right luminosity function of quasars. You get just about the right radio luminosity function. To do that calculation, you've got to take into account the spin of the black holes and follow that through the merging and the growth of everything, and that kind of works out okay. You can then start looking at things like the radio loudness of black holes as a function of their host halo mass, for instance. And I'll show you that plot tomorrow, and you can tell me whether you believe it. But so largely things work. The thing that doesn't work very well is the evolution of the radioluminosity function. And that's because most of the clusters are formed late in the history of the universe. Those are where you need a lot of energy input from the black hole. Whereas the radioluminosity function, as you know, is many bright, very bright radio sources at quite high redshift. That seems to be a struggle to explain that in the model. Possibly what we're doing is that the radio luminosity, we're mixing up components that are due to the environment, how the jet tries to escape from the galaxy and gets mixed as it tries to flow through material, with the kind of radio emission that you'd expect from the core of the jet itself. So we're mixing these two things together, and we really need to model those two components of radio emission separately. So, yes, we've looked at it, and it kind of works. But not, you know, I'm not Carlos. I'm not going to claim that it works completely. There's still some things to be understood there. Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah, so what's sort of the most bothersome thing about your model is it doesn't have any propagation. Just have this local stuff going on. And so
yeah.
Nothing's influencing anything else.
So everything is local within a halo. I agree. And I skipped over the movie, which shows you that that isn't accurate. Right? But what is actually happening, we began to get into this with this F eject that somebody wanted me to explain. Right? Now, that is still local in the sense that we only ever consider it one halo. So we allow material to be expelled from a halo at one moment in time, and then it's caught back by the same halo when that halo has grown in mass and the binding energy has changed. But what we don't allow at the moment is to take material from one halo to expel it from this halo and then have it drop into another halo over here. And the only way to do that is to do the calculation the hard way, the computer, and wind through all that proper fluid dynamics. Now, there's a hope that it doesn't matter too much, though, which is probably why where we've done comparisons with the full numerical calculation and with this way of doing things, it works quite well. And that's when you heat up the material and expel it from the halo, you give it a lot of entropy. So it's quite hard for that material to just drop into another halo. It just remains smooth. It tends to remain smooth until the halo as a whole has grown in mass. And then it doesn't really matter. You know, everything is clustering together. So essentially, it ends up in the same successor to the halo that you expelled it from. But you can certainly, when you look at a numerical simulation, your first reaction is, how does this work? Because the material gets blown out into the voids. It's not obvious you can do everything locally. But I think because of the way the entropy works, it's not as bad as an approximation as you might think.
Okay. Let's thank our speaker.